The Defence Electronics History Society Spring Lecture, May 2007, held at the Lander Lecture Theatre, Shrivenham, on the 10th of May 2007. The first presentation, Taffy Boyne, Saint or Sinner, The Controversy Over Early Airborne Radar, was given by Phil Judkins and lasts 40 minutes. The second presentation, Alan Blumlein, His Life and Work in Radar, was given by his son Simon Blumlein and lasts for 37 minutes. The first speaker is Phil Judkins.
Taffy Boyne, saint or sinner? My talk's going to be today to challenge allegations made by a historian, David Zimmerman, about Eddie Taffy Boyne, the creator of AI and ASV radar. But I want to use this as an example of why I want DEHS to take part in more controversies, to set the Defence Electronic History agenda straight. Let me start with the words of DEHS's very own prophet of controversy, Peter Waddell, in the last transmission lines. I used to think that Peter was exaggerating. Then I started looking at history books for my PhD, and I'm not sure anymore. I began to look at what political historians were writing about radar. These quotes are direct from one standard, weighty textbook. Rowe might have been quite delighted to be Elliot Verdon Rowe of Lancaster Bomber fame, but he wasn't. And was there ever a better reason for Colin and Ann Latham to restore Skip Wilkins to his right place? The problem is that statements like that, if they're not challenged, become the basis for some quite interesting views, like these that build on Middlemass and Barnes. So in today's history books, we see that radar is merely an excellent sound locator, which the politicians simply ordered up. No place anymore for all those boring facts about Rowe searching the Air Ministry's 53A defence files, finding nothing and writing to Wimperis. It would no doubt have been salutary for Tizard, Watson, Watt and Rowe to know how their work was regarded if comments like this were true. It might also be very interesting for the Germans to know that they didn't have pulse technique until 1939. Or for Bright and Tuve to know that they couldn't have used it in July and August 1925 because Watson Watt hadn't invented it yet. That's why DEHS needs to engage in discussion with historians. Rose, by the way, is not at all a maverick historian. He is a very well-respected historian of prize-winning status. But my subject today is another historian, David Zimmerman, and the comments he makes about Taffy Boyne in his book Britain's Shield. What I've given you here are direct quotes from pages 224-6 of that book, and they are very grave charges indeed. Essentially, Boyne is accused that at a demonstration of AI to Dowding on the 30th of June 1939, he misrepresented to Dowding the minimum range that AI could achieve, and the result was that Dowding ordered so many sets that the AI team was swamped and prevented from creating a working AI that would have defeated the Luftwaffe's night blitz. Because our inability to defeat that blitz led to Dowding's dismissal, Boyne stands accused of that too. 43,000 deaths, major damage to critical industries and dismissal of a CNC. Boyne's a major war criminal on those counts. Now, I'll deal first with the fact that some may feel, but we won the blitz. I'm afraid you just have to look at the figures. In the Battle of Britain, we downed 1,733 Luftwaffe aircraft of all types. We claimed 2,692, by the way. In the early blitz, there were about 12,000 Luftwaffe sorties and just 8 were downed by the RAF, plus 54 by anti-aircraft. Actually, we lost more airmen than the Luftwaffe. The fact is that the bad winter of 1940-41 spared us, and it was only after March 1941 that we began to get all our ducks in a row. At that point, we began to get the measure of the blitz. But by then, the Luftwaffe planners were already occupied on Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia. So the question is really, could night interception capability have been delivered 6 months earlier? And if so, why wasn't it? Now, at this point, I could take you along a familiar path with Boyne's radar days, Hanbury Brown's Boffin, Keith Wood's Echoes and Reflections, Lovell's Echoes of War. I could even bring in some new facts about ASV and AI from the unpublished historical account written during the war by Gerald Touch, Boyne's number two. I've illustrated some extracts on the display panels outside. It's an excellent document that someone ought to publish. Hint, hint. But I won't. The answer is not there. As the Defence Council, I also won't cover who invented what. In war, no one cares, and the answer isn't there either anyway. To testify to the fact that no one really cares, I call Michael, a household name as an inventor, but without much in the bank. Perhaps if I use his proper name in his native tongue, Mikhail Kalashnikov, you will know him better. My defence will also not cover in any depth details of aircraft, guns or fuel. That will be mentioned in passing only. Now, last year, Richard Holmes stimulated our thoughts about D-Day by looking wide of the Normandy beaches. This year, on a lot less elevated level, I'm going to try to do the same as I defend Taffy Bowen. Nowadays, when MOD spends money, it tries to acquire a capability rather than simply buying hardware, on the basis that there might be more than one way to skin the cat. The Tizard Committee did the same. Its terms of reference were deliberately broad to see how science could help in air defence, and whatever Rose may think, it was not simply told, go away and invent a better sound locator. It's here that we'll find the answer to Bowen's supposed guilt, as we'll see. The radar histories, the signals history, Bowen, Hanbury, Brown and so on, all focus on AI radar interception as if that was the answer that everybody was working towards. This is absolutely not the case, as we shall see. The answer is to look at what people were actually doing, not what they said later that they were doing. The other elements that we need to look at nowadays when acquiring a capability illustrate the fact that you don't get a capability just by acquiring hardware. You need to have some idea of when and where to use it, doctrine and concepts. You need to house it somewhere and feed it power, infrastructure. You need to maintain it and move it if need be, sustainability. You have to recruit folk to build it, to maintain it, that's recruitment. They need to be in some sort of structure and be directed in what they do, organisation. They need to be taught the skills of operating and maintaining it, training. The information it contains has to be communicated in a usable form, C3I as we call it nowadays, not much C4I, the extra C being computing, in 1935. And finally, all of it has to work seamlessly together. You need all of that for successful AI night interception. And it's absolutely obvious that Bowen was not responsible for most of that. And this defence will look at whether it could ever have been done in the time. What I'll do, as Taffy's defence counsel, is to ask you to keep some questions in mind. Was there a different origin than Taffy Bowen to AI being late at the party? One which, by not looking wide of radar, historians don't give enough weight to. How did the Tizard Committee really view AI radar? Was it seen as critical for the night battle? What really did happen as a result of that demonstration to Dowding in July 1939? If more than AI was needed to achieve night interception, say you needed Chain Home or GCI as well, why had nobody thought of that? After all, Tizard's committee had done a very good job of linking all the aspects of day interception together. Some of the argument is about whether AI had a small enough minimum range. Was that true? Did it matter? And finally, since Bowen is accused of being a con man, is there any other evidence of that before 1939 or since? And if Dowding was deceived so much, was Dowding a credulous sort of person? Keeping those points in mind, what does the evidence tell us? Well, everybody in 1934 had experience of Zeppelins in the First World War and of the air exercises between the wars. Zeppelins, of course, were anything up to 700 feet long and moved at about 80 miles an hour, if the wind wasn't against them, depending, and they were moderately easy to find and hold in searchlights, helped by sound locators. The blind were recruited to man sound locators in 1915, by the way, because, of course, extra oral sensitivity. Gotha bombers were more tricky, but the same basic concept was used. Light up the sky and fight with day tactics. Between the wars, up to 1934, RAF doctrine was go and bomb the enemy airfields, and if that doesn't suffice, cooperate with searchlights and guns, but you don't have much chance of night interception anyway. The Trenchard doctrine of bombing deterrence didn't leave a lot for training night fighters. Squadrons had to produce just 9 a year, and 5 hours was the actual training time. You might guess that the pilots were just about capable of landing without crashing at night. Even by the end of 1940, Britain had just 84 qualified night fighter pilots, 74 less than what they wanted. And by qualified, I just mean 5 hours night flying. Given rotas, casualty, sickness, training, and aircraft which were US, that means less than 10 fighters flying on most nights. How much damage are you going to do with just 10 fighters up? Whatever else, Taffy was not responsible for that. Annual air exercises produce very reassuring night interception rates, as you can see here, 59%, 60%, 73%. Carping critics might point out that night interception is easier if the enemy has to leave its navigation lights on, which they did for peacetime safety rules. The concept then, light up the sky and fight with day tactics. Most histories regard radar as the only item on the Tizard Committee's agenda. Read the minutes. That isn't how the Tizard Committee saw it. They spent a lot of time on meteorology, AA gunnery, and sound locators. They kept sound locators on the agenda until well into 1940. Histories also regard Lindemann as a destructive crank. It's worth reading his correspondence before you finally decide. His dispute with Tizard was about priorities. Should the research focus on night and cloudy days? That's about 80% of the time we have in the UK. Or should it focus on cloudless days? That's maybe 20% of the time, at best. And it was where Tizard wanted to start. As to aerial minefields, Lindemann's ideas continued to be progressed by the Tizard Committee beyond the outbreak of war, 3 years after Lindemann had left it. In 1935, the Tizard Committee's answers to night interception were searchlights, but its researchers discovered these were useless in cloud or poor weather. They could only be used about a third of the time. So what to do about the other two-thirds? It's Rowe who, in Christmas 1935, comes up with a suggestion to illuminate the cloud base so that high-flying fighters can look down and see the silhouette of bombers flying across it. The other point that perhaps we ought to note is that before radar even started, Dowding insisted on the Daventry experiment, as we know, much to Watson Watt's great disgust. Dowding's comment was, "These fellows can prove anything with figures." He doesn't sound to be a very credulous type, the sort that would be taken in by con men. So the Tizard Committee in 1936 pushed ahead with trials at Farnborough on silhouette, lighting up the clouds. And you can see just above halfway up there, the plane visible against cloud illumination, in this case by flares. The idea had been tried in World War I. It was usable on about a third of nights, so together with searchlights covering another third, about 70% of nights were now covered, and the remainder were probably too bad for flying. Silhouette was fortunate in three ways. Its sponsor was A.V. Hill, a Nobel laureate and a World War I senior gunnery officer. It was fortunate in its timing. It came in as a proposal, really, in late 1936, after the disastrous September 1936 air exercise, which showed that the high-tech of radar didn't always work. Lighting, by contrast, was known technology. And finally, the doctrine fitted with what the RAF wanted to do, use day fighters in an artificially lit-up night sky, needing no special tactics. And if radar did work, well then, the big-in-hell tactics which they'd just worked out would suffice. Mad as a suggestion? Well, wait a minute. Bowen, of course, was picking up airborne radar as a part-time role during the spring of that year. And the first thing he did was to ask the RAF for guidance on how they carried out night interception. He reports, and you can read it in Radar Days, there were twice as many ways as people he asked. So he focused on attacking the hardware challenge, cramming chain home into an aircraft. That was challenge enough. Early in the process, there weren't the valves to generate the RF power for an airborne set. There wasn't even enough in the way of power supplies in the aircraft anyway. And the transmitter weighed too much, so he decided to leave the transmitter on the ground and equip the aircraft with the receiver only, the RDF 1.5, RDF 1.5 concept. He built a prototype of that in the towers at Bordsey, and this worked extremely well. It probably saved radar at the time of those disastrous 1936 air exercises. When the main chain home produced not much in the way of results, Dowding was shown Bowen's equipment instead. It worked and worked excellently well. Big tick for Taffy. Now, silhouette. Fast forward to 1943 and the raids on Hamburg, the Gomorrah raids. The German tactical response, Wildesau, or Wild Boar, free night fighting, employed the same tactic of silhouette. Searchlights and substantial fires illuminated the cloud base, and Hadjo Herman's day fighters could be fed into the fray. Looking down, they could see the bombers silhouetted against the burning city. Soon, the RAF loss rates were rising again. The Germans called the technique Mattscheibe, ground glass screen is about the best translation I can think of, or Leichenturm, shroud, and they enhanced it by dropping flares from above. You will, of course, observe one drawback. The technique works best not with the concentrated beam of the searchlight, but with a very diffuse light source, the flames of the city that you were trying to protect, in fact. The British didn't intend to use the flames of their cities, but multiple lighting units spread over a wide area with broad beam reflectors on the ground pointing upwards. Tests at Farnborough in November 36 proved moderately successful, and the Tizard Committee sought Treasury approval for a full experimental scheme over an area of Essex. This experimental scheme cost £400,000. 60 million today, if you like, but remember that radar's experimental £10,000 was just 2.5% of that, and the entire UK radar chain at that time stood at about 1 million. 400,000 for an experimental scheme. Does anybody seriously contend that the CSSAD thought that this was just an interesting idea? This was their answer to night attack. Even though the idea was backed by Hill, a Nobel laureate, the Treasury balked, as well they might. And when eventually it gave its approval just to the experimental area, it was on the understanding that if the scheme went ahead, the electrical generating capacity would be useful for farm electrification until it was called on for defence. Part of my research has identified that, astonishingly, one silhouette site actually survives in Essex. Remember, it looks nothing so much like a set of derelict farm buildings. They're arranged in a 12-sided box on a concrete base 60 feet across, and in the plan view looks something like an annular ring. On the top were arrayed originally 3-kilowatt floodlights in two rings with reflectors arranged to give a diffuse beam and a switching position in the centre. The sketch that is there is the only drawing I've found. It's a sketch by an Army subaltern of the time. Bowen, meanwhile? Bowen didn't have £400,000. Bowen didn't have 400,000 pennies. He says he was told by Watson Watt to drop RDF 1.5 and concentrate on RDF 2, the all-airborne radar. However, as both the Tizard Committee minutes and Keith Wood's diary make quite clear, Bowen carried on developing both RDF 1 and RDF 1.5, not least because of the problems of weight if the transmitter was put in the aircraft and of the power the transmitter consumed and the lack of transmitter valves. Eventually, the 4316 doorknob valve became available. Enough power was generated for the first fully airborne radar echoes to be seen. Ground features first of all, then on the 17th of August, the 70th anniversary this year, the first 1.25 metre ASV echoes from a 2,000-ton freighter. Following this, the focus of Bowen's team moved to ASV. The fleet was found in the famous painting on the exhibition boards outside. Demonstrations were given to Tizard, to Paris, to Squadron Leader Hart. What is important is that by the end of that year, 1937, ASV is working, if erratically. AI is too, but rather rarely so. But AI is not the Tizard Committee's planning option. The Tizard Committee had been planning on silhouette, and in 1937, both RDF 1.5 and RDF 2 were B priority projects. I have the priority sheets here for the people who would want to look at them. Even after the success of ASV, October's Tizard Committee emphasised RDF 1.5, just the receiver in the aircraft, transmitter on the ground. Every effort is to be made to develop RDF 1.5, it said. But what is noticeable about the Tizard Committee in 1938 is that its focus for night defence was anything but AI. In particular, it concentrated on the building of the experimental silhouette area. This is a section of Essex from Chelmsford in the top to Southend in the south. There are 43 of the sites there that I've managed to be able to identify. Each one of those used 400 kilowatts of electricity. This is a time when many towns wouldn't have that generating capacity. The first test site was at Rayleigh. RAE Farnborough managed the whole build. The Tizard Committee concerned itself only with the occasional scientific problems that came up, design of reflectors, reasons for lamp failure. The cost of extending this to the London area, a scheme that covered 40 miles by 26, was first estimated at £2 million and then £2.5 million. Compare with this the estimated spend at that point on the entire chain home system, £1.2 million. Silhouette as a national defence system, nationally, not just London, was estimated at £7.5 million, about £1.1 billion today. Even more startling is the presence among the Tizard Committee's papers of a proposal to stimulate an artificial aurora borealis using a 500 kilowatt of RF feeding into a grid of 800 horizontal half-wave aerials 50 metres up on a frequency of 1.4 megs. Don't believe me? I have the evidence here. The subject, it was referred for further inquiry, not proceeded with because of cost, and it was raised again in September 1940 before being quashed by Rowe. What it does illustrate is how strong a grip the idea of lighting up the sky and using day fighter techniques had on senior scientists and service people, and one is bound to wonder if the shortage of night pilots didn't have a lot to do with that. A conference in June 1938 showed there would be only one night fighter squadron per sector during the winter nights. Only one flight of three planes would be aloft in each sector at any one time. Hardly, again, Taffy Bowen's fault. 1938 was Taffy's ASV year. He focused more on ASV than AI, testing out different aerial configurations. The smudgy left-hand picture is the famous sideways-looking picture of radar on HMS Courageous. Touch says the Admiralty actually ordered six sets, though they were in the end never delivered. But certainly Joubert, as CNC of Coastal Command, was impressed by the demonstration he had in July. Remember, Bowen was still testing both RDF 1.5 and RDF 2. He implies in radar days that RDF 1.5 was allowed to lapse before March 1937 because Watson Watt was unconvinced of it. And Bowen goes on to write exclusively about ASV and AI. I'm afraid the evidence is against him. A July 1938 paper by Watson Watt and Pye reveals that both those systems were being developed, and that they were seen as useful for aircraft that would shadow and report in on incoming bomber formations rather than actual interceptions. Touch is quite blunt about saying the truth was that little attention was paid to AI until the latter half of the year. In 1939, reality gradually bites. There was a lot of activity in the first quarter, but most of it wasn't really about AI. It was about town detection and contour navigation years before H2S. Bowen, by the way, on this was not off on a frolic of his own. It is crystal clear from Rowe's report on priorities at Bordsey that these were approved programs with A or A star priority status. ASV and primitive AI were seen as equally important, and RDF 1.5 was alive and kicking. Please note here, Rowe was very, very supportive of Bowen's work, whatever he might have thought of Bowen personally. There was no interest from the RAF in these ideas for navigation, so Bowen moved on to creating working AI in a battle, with a two-tube display and lobe switching to deliver both azimuth and elevation homing. Thanks to Norman Groom, we can see this same display here in AI-4, live and working. A brilliant feat of work, Norman. Thank you. A first demonstration was given to Rowe, and Rowe is absolutely not renowned for liking Bowen, and it left Rowe greatly enthused. Copies of the letter are actually up on the exhibition boards outside, because he straight away communicated that to Dowding. But before Dowding could make the trip to AI, Dowding had a very different conference to attend on air interception. Much of the debate at that conference, which was led by Tizard, was about aerial minefields and how to lay them. It was not about how to do interceptions. The rest of the discussion was around the blockages created by lack of effective IFF and ground-to-air-to-ground RT beyond the coast. 2 days later, Dowding received Bowen's demonstration, and he was very impressed. And this is the essence of Zimmerman's accusation of deception, so let's look at it a bit more closely. Both Bowen and Dowding have left accounts, and Zimmerman calls them remarkably contradictory. In fact, there isn't any real contradiction within them. Dowding emphasised, first of all, that without IFF, a 300-foot minimum range was critical for recognition of the plane you were closing on if the RAF wasn't to shoot down its own bombers. The demonstration flight in a battle was carried out with Bowen and Dowding under a hood, controlling the pilot from the tube display. When the hood was removed, Dowding couldn't see the target plane and said, "Where is it?" Bowen said, "Vertically above us." They were directly underneath it. In the afternoon, Dowding, who had been told that 300 yards was the minimum range, was told by Bowen there had been a sensational advance and the minimum range had now been cut to 220 feet. This, in Zimmerman's view, caused Dowding to rush 21 sets into aircraft and thus wreck the entire AI program. Why is minimum range such a contentious problem? Well, as Richard Trim could probably tell us, because of the lack at that time of reliable IFF. At this date, identifying yourself was a complicated business. If you were a British plane over the UK, you flew along, tapping out the letter of the day in Morse on something attached to the side of your cockpit, which operated a light underneath your plane, pointing downwards with a filter on it for the colour of the day. There was another light that pointed upwards, so if you actually wanted to keep off the fighters who were above you, you switched one of the switches to pointing upwards, and if you wanted to keep off the guns from shooting you down below, you switched the other switch to down below. Sometimes, of course, your knee brushed against the switch. And if you want a perfect example, it's in Bowen's radar days, of how one of Her Majesty's submarines was actually attacked by a German plane in mistake for Bowen's experimental Hudson, precisely because of the fact that the Hudson was certainly tapping out its identification letters, but someone had actually brushed against the switch and they were tapping them out pointing upwards as opposed to pointing downwards. If you were a bomber coming back from a raid, you were supposed to fly down a safe channel. Easier said than done with night navigation as it was in 1939. You had to rely on challenge and reply on your trusty 1082-83 set, which I have brought along. The only problem was you had to change the coils to get on the right frequency. So imagine yourself, please, on a bomber coming back from Germany. You have to change two of these coils into here. You have to pull out two coils here and fit in two more coil packs. Then retune. Imagine that you're wearing thick gloves. Imagine that condensation has actually frozen the coils into place. Tricky. So visual range was a necessity to be sure it was an enemy. But tests done before the war showed a huge variation in what visual range was according to the weather, the phase of the moon, up moon or down moon position, above or below the target and so on. Well, what actually resulted from that demonstration to Dowding? Well, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, decide for yourselves. You do need to read what Dowding actually said, which isn't easy because it's actually in a PRO file at Kew, which is mislabeled. Here it is, and it actually doesn't sound like a very credulous man. What he said, a good deal of development's required. We can disabuse our minds of any notion that it'll work inside a year. We know we cannot win the night battle because we can't intercept by night. He actually recommended four sets be supplied at once to develop tactics and training. It was Watson Watt who in fact said, "Oh, four sets is easy. Bowen can make by hand 21 by the end of September, no impact on anything." The Air Ministry therefore took him at his word and ordered the lot. The sensational advance that Bowen claimed in reducing the minimum range, was that a lie? I don't think there's a mystery in it. The AI transmitter then was a self-oscillating squagger which has a notoriously long tail on its pulse. Touch's note shows that he was working on his quenching circuit at that time, using a transmitter feed to cut off the receiver oscillator and shorten the minimum range. There's no need to regard Bowen's claim as a mere invention, fiction or fib, though undoubtedly Bowen might have been very ebullient in telling Dowding there was a good chance of a lower minimum range. Equally, Dowding had by now over 4 years of Watson Watt's salesmanship. We can see by his actions, ordering just four sets, that this was no conversion on the road to Damascus. It was just an order for a few sets for trials and training, overtaken by a larger ministry order with Watson Watt's active encouragement. The silhouette experiment, which we left covering most of Essex, did not stand the test of war. In late 1939, it proved ineffective. It consumed huge and scarce generator capacity. It couldn't be quickly extended. It had also managed to blow up Canewdon's chain home receiver capacitors. Why? Well, think about it. What's going to happen when you switch off from the national grid and local generators? 50-odd sets consuming 300 kilowatts a time. The power surge took Canewdon's mains input voltage up to 300 volts and blew the entire receiver power pack out. AI was at least at this time on the service agenda, but it was not by any stretch of the imagination the only or even a major priority. For the defence, the urgent need was to build up the gun and searchlight defences and improve the sound locators. The talents of Alan Blumlein were applied to create the visual indicating equipment in August 1939. And contrary to the view that radar was all-pervading, the VIE apparatus remained in use until 1944. The first fitting of AI to 25 Squadron revealed exactly the type of operational problems Dowding wanted to flush out. Hanbury Brown records his shock at being told to move the gear to the back of the Blenheim, as he hadn't realised that the valve glow of the unshielded transmitter made it a perfect target for German gunners. Nor had it been realised that the pipsqueak DF timer that actually put your local radio set on to transmit for 15 seconds cuts off the intercom for 15 seconds as well. So if you are doing a chase of a German aircraft and 15 seconds out of every 60 of instructions from the radar observer to the pilot is cut off, you are going to have a problem. At that time, of course, chain home was still being used to try to navigate people close enough to switch on their AIs. It was realised by Hanbury Brown that they couldn't handle that. It was too inaccurate and too slow to operate. Dowding valiantly tried to continue with using chain home for that purpose until late in 1939. Squadron leader Tester, trying to operate a chain home himself with two targets, no PPI and no IFF, I suspect was probably quite glad to retire to Bletchley Park instead. Bowen, meanwhile, suffered every practical problem possible. Though the Bawdsey Dundee move settled down after a while, the AI team with their fitting work had two disastrous moves in succession. Scone and then St Athan, where conditions would have caused a riot in a prison farm. The team were overwhelmed by fitting out work. Most of it was for the Coastal Command and the Navy, and was down to Watts and Watts' lack of control, not to Dowding. The team also began to split apart over priorities. Touch took the view that time was too short now to do anything other than make metric AI work. Lovell, in one of the DEHS oral interviews, they do have a purpose, remembers Touch as endlessly on the phone to the manufacturers, and he moved to RAE. Tizard wanted to bring in more of outside industry, specifically GEC. Dowding concurred, but Dowding specifically asked that EMI be brought in, with Blumlein, who had impressed him. Bowen became the go-between on that activity. It certainly put him into microwaves, but it probably didn't endear him to Rowe and Lewis, who were against the use of GEC. There are certainly flashes of annoyance in Rowe's letters to Patterson. In 1940 began, there are two parallel streams of research, one originating with Lewis in Dundee and one with Bowen, nominally at St Athan, but often on the trialled airfields. Lewis, by all accounts, was a man very famously disposed to thinking through problems for himself. Certainly on this occasion he didn't involve Bowen. At the end of 1939 he instructed Dummer to work on the radial time base, the foundation of PPI, one of the four keys to GCI. Work at Douglas Wood focused on improving the chain home low aerial system, a second key. So far as the airborne gear was concerned, the problem as it was expressed to Lewis was that the RAF saw 100 yards minimum range as critical. Certainly they'd been saying 100 yards minimum range was required since 1938. AI-3 would give 900 feet in tests. AI-3B, a little bit better but with loss of maximum range and the addition of weight. AI-3B was dropped. Bowen, by contrast, was focusing on fitting AI and ASV, and as time allowed, working on RDF with 1.5 still, using it with chain home low, a system called AIL, to defeat the problem of low-flying German mine layers. In this case, conventional AI would not have worked well, as the sea returns would have obscured the target trace. Impatient for progress, the RAF formed a night interception committee. In that committee, aerial minefields were seen as the key. AI was still seen as a means to that end. The committee discussed a lot but had no quick answers. It pushed ahead with fitting AI to Blenheim's. A positive result was the establishment of the fighter interception unit under the meticulous Peter Chamberlain. His painstaking approach began to eliminate some of the faults of AI. The scientists were amazed to discover that AI indeed had a squint that was cleared by changing the polarisation of the aerial from horizontal to vertical. But in practical terms, what is more relevant is that the Air Ministry, tired of endless modifications to AI, froze the AI design and carried on fitting AI-3 with the known less effective horizontal aerials. At Easter, Lewis allocated the redesign of AI-3 and solution of the minimum range problem to EMI and Blumlein, while Bowen, amid his pressing commitments to fit more and more AI, more beacons, ASV and so on, pushed on with AIL, one good reason being that he was instructed to do just that by his boss's boss, Sir George Lee. The letter again is on the board outside. It was a direct instruction. At the top level of the services, the Night Interception Committee still saw the counter to night bombing as aerial mine laying. Lindemann, its progenitor, was now in the ascendant with Churchill having become the Prime Minister. Tizard saw his influence fading, and after the episode where he opposed Lindemann's protege, R.V. Jones, here, over the German bombing beams and was proven wrong, Tizard resigned. This left Dowding without senior scientific support, with the Battle of Britain to fight and the Blitz to prepare for. It left Bowen alone too. Tizard was without a role, but he was now to render the immeasurable service of leading the mission to the USA and Canada. Bowen, increasingly out of a job once RDF 1.5 had proven flawed, joined as the radar expert bringing the Cavity Magnetron to the USA. For those left in Britain, the Battle of Britain was still raging, and the Air Ministry at this time was strongly pushing the redeployment of single-engine fighters as night fighters, thereby finding a role for the Defiant. But remember, please, we only had 84 pilots on night fighting. The spotlight turned onto the missing GCI piece of the jigsaw. There was amazingly still a debate about whether GCI was even necessary. This is in the third quarter of 1940. Watson Watt's old guard was still actively pursuing chain home interceptions as late as October. Fortunately, in the field, work was pushed ahead to bring together the four main components of GCI, PPI, 360-degree rotation, continuous height finding and the single aerial solution. I personally believe that GCI is a disgracefully neglected part of the radar achievement. It isn't a part of my talk today, but I hope my thesis will actually rectify that position. Dowding found his position increasingly weakened. He tried using gun-laying sets to be able to guide searchlights to show the pilots where the enemy was. It failed. The gun-laying sets were still erratic in operation. Civilian losses mounted. GCI was eventually placed at Durrington in mid-October, but Dowding's position was then so far weakened that he was replaced the morning before the Coventry raid. The first kill by the Durrington GCI was only a couple of days later. Sholto Douglas, who took over from Dowding, demanded more planes, more AI, but neither planes nor pilots were available. Eventually, the Sopley GCI, with Squadron Leader Brown, developed the interception tactics we needed. Weather in the winter of 1941 was memorably foul. The raids fell right off. It gave us time to build the GCIs, time to develop gun laying for AA, for all the training, the tactics and the maintenance to catch up. The Luftwaffe losses rose, but in May they turned away to attack Russia. By the way, over the 8 months that I'm talking about, AI-assisted fighters shot down about 94 planes, but Cat's Eyes fighters shot down 110. It might be an interesting reflection as to whether if we'd concentrated on GCI instead of AI, there might have been more casualties. Anyway, all of the intercepted bombers, by the way, had actually been visually sighted at between 1,200 and 1,500 feet, not the 300 feet that the scientists were trying to drive towards. So, Bowen, Saint or Sinner? Well, in the late 1930s, silhouette was the favoured solution. AI was a long shot. ASV was seen as being a lot more use, and it needed no new tactics. When AI did work, it was seen as being useful for aerial minefields, so nobody was developing night interception tactics. The need to develop those tactics was Dowding's motive for action, not Bowen's claims, and Bowen's sensational advance, I believe, has a credible basis. Dowding's tests certainly revealed the flaws that he expected, And there were the solutions forthcoming from Bowen and Hanbury Brown, but then they were overtaken by the relocations, by the fitting work they had to do. Bowen was quite right about the fact that the minimum range problem was essentially illusory. But ultimately, the solutions were better product engineering of airborne interception equipment in the planes, the GCI on the ground, but most of all, time for the training of the maintainers, the operators, and the pilots in the tactics. Saint or sinner, beyond any reasonable doubt? Well, for me, Taffy is a Welsh saint. Maybe slightly flawed, but a saint nonetheless. Perhaps his emblem is an AI-4 aerial. Thank you very much indeed.
Phil Judkins can be contacted by email at philjudkins@blueyonder.co.uk. The second presentation, Alan Blumlein, His Life and Work in Radar, is given by Simon Blumlein.
I'm not an electronic engineer. I have done some electronics. I had to do it in my work. But there's a lot of people, I'm sure, here that are not electronic engineers as well. So that gets me out of too technical bit. But I've got to try in 40 minutes to speak about my father and radar. And if you think he took 128 patents out in 17 working years, it's a lot to get through. But I'm going to mention a little bit about his life and a little bit of what I remember. He was killed when I was 6, and therefore my memory has been built really backwards. And I believe in life there's never a little bad without a bit of good. You don't want the bit of bad, but the little bit of good is that through his brain I've learnt to know my father. And I'm still learning. I was learning this morning. I've learnt more this afternoon. And I hope to continue learning on. He was born in Hampstead, the son of Semi Josef Blumlein. That's an 1895 photograph. He went to South Africa. He was not allowed to remain in Germany by his parents. He was sent to England and then went to South Africa, met my grandmother Jessie Edwards, came back Hampstead, and my father, life carried on from there. He went to various schools, one of which was a little bit like Dartington, and he didn't work that hard. I did more gymnastics than engineering. But he also was sent to a crammer, and within 2 years he'd got exhibitions to at least 2 schools, but his mother decided that not Aldenham, it was too classical, and to send him to Highgate. So in 1915, he went to Highgate and spent 3 years there, and then got his entry to City and Guilds, which was one of the 3 colleges that make up the place we now know as Imperial College. He went in 1921, and within 2 years he took a first-class honours degree in light electrical engineering. There was no such thing, of course, in those days as an electronics degree. But he had to take it externally because it was a 4-year course and you're meant to stay there for 4 years if you do it with the internal. So he came out, and his father, my grandfather, died in 1914, and the family didn't have that much money then, and he really had to find somewhere where he could earn a little. And he was recommended to Mallet, who was running the telephone and telephony course at City and Guilds. And he spent a year with Mallet, and that was him at 12, before he went to this crammer, and he had to get his feet down. With Mallet, he spent a year. So at the age of 21, he and his professor wrote a paper the title of which is on the board, and I do have a copy here. Please don't take it because it's the only copy I have. It won, well, first of all, it's rejected because improves the English, etc., etc., but it went back and it won a premium. And so at the age of 21, he won his first IEEE premium. He only presented two papers to the IE as such, and the second one, much later, also won a premium. So he then had to get employment. Mac, who was at what was now Standard Telephone and Cables, was recommended to take on this young telephony engineer. At first, the story goes, because his father was Jewish, Standard in those days, or the International Western Electric, didn't employ Jews. But anyhow, he went there, and he met this gentleman, J.B. Kay, who said to me, there was actually three jokers in the laboratory that day. Usually there's one, but the three of them were there. There was J.B. Kay, my father, and Dr. Latimer, nicknamed Fatty Latimer, who went on to do submarine cables and things like that. J.B. became his best man and also my godfather. And terrific amount of information, very luckily, has come from J.B. If you go to the British Sound Archive Library, at the British Library, you can hear the tapes that he's deposited there. And it makes very, very interesting listening. Anyhow, my father went on to work on telephone lines, and he suddenly realized that you couldn't measure capacitance very accurately. He had to build lines. He was helping lay cables across Switzerland, Germany, Paris, Strasbourg cables, and he was having difficulty with the measurement of capacitance and inductance. So he sat down and designed a new AC bridge, and this AC bridge is still used to this day and is the fundamental of measuring. If you want to measure capacitance to a nanofarad, anyone here knows what a nanofarad is? It's actually 10 to the minus 18 farads. I know the farad's quite a big thing, but when you get down to the 10 to the minus 18, it really is. And as a by thought, it went on and used as an altimeter many years later by the Air Force. They put capacitor plates on the wing and measured the capacitance between the wing and the ground. They scaled the milliammeter from 0 to 150 feet, and some of these brave night flyers, I assume, 5 hours training, landed with it. But it was very, very accurate at certain places. Of course, you couldn't use normal altimeters at such a low level, and this was one of the suggestions. I'm hopping a bit, but I'm trying to talk about the things that were relevant during the war. He did other things with other patents in Standard Electric, but in 1928-29, Schoenberg was looking, he was at Columbia, for an engineer to improve on Western Electric's patent, which meant that, if you remember old 78 records, they all had a stamp on, and you paid a penny or something to press each record. He sent Blumlein to interview, and my father cheekily said to him, "Yes, thank you very much, but I don't think you can afford me." Sheer cheek. And he said, "Well, how much do you want?" And Schoenberg doubled it. And so he went on to produce the HB mic. My mother always talked of it as, it's called HB because he used to say hell's bells and got hot and bothered. But the truth is that it's the Holman-Blumlein mic. that used a moving coil, which was actually just one piece of aluminium, one circle of aluminium. But there is this other lovely story about him. I shouldn't digress again. But one day, somebody looking down at the yard at EMI saw a chap in a cloth cap and workman's uniform staggering across with a great big beam over his shoulder. He was nearly on the ground. And he came out of one door across the square and into the other and disappeared. And this chap was totally amazed, but of course he'd never heard of balsa wood. And balsa wood was used in such microphones. He really was a brilliant joker, and I'll come back to that. From there, he went on to move to EMI. He'd just got this microphone and the recording unit, and EMI was formed of HMV and Columbia. I know he got very upset one day, and he came to my mother and said, "Look, HMV have got an advertisement. Our engineers have been working for years on this recording thing." And of course he was never part of HMV, but it was successful, and a room was made available at Abbey Road to put this in, and it became the recording system at Abbey Road. Long before the Beatles went across the zebra crossing in the very early 30s. From there, he went to work on stereo, and I mention stereo because Phil mentioned the sound locator, and it was through his work on stereo that he was able to improve on that, and we'll come to that. This is the Blumlein Holman coil stereo. It's 1933. I do have recordings of my father actually walking across his lab and saying to Trot, "Did you get that, Trot?" And he picked up or put a different loading in. I mentioned Trot again, and I shall come back to him. Anyhow, he had to stop any further work on stereo, and it was years ahead of its time. It was bought out in 1958 in the end. And journalists knocked on my mother's door and said, "Are you a millionaireess overnight?" And of course, we didn't get a penny from it. But they walked away in typical media style. I hope there's some media members listening. Because it was thought, really, that this was an American invention, and the Americans tried to make it out an American invention, and they are now beginning to agree that it was Blumlein. In 1931, he applied for the patent. It was granted in 1933. So we were way ahead of the Americans there, and you're going to see very quickly why we're ahead of the Americans on. Because he stopped any more work on stereo, although he did apply for one or two more patents, extra bits, and EMI decided to have work on television. I don't know whether we could see it like this these days. Imagine a company, and the reason why they developed a television system was to sell the receivers, of course. This was EMI's mass production unit. You don't make many television cameras, but without even one television camera, you'll never sell a decent television set. And they bought in people like McGee, and this is a good chance to mention, we have here with us Richard Brown, whose father, C.O. Brown, worked with my father and was in the air crash. I only met him this afternoon, and wonderful it is. He might like to say something in the discussion. Anyhow, they went on, and he produced a great number of patents to do with television. In 1934, there was a gathering at his house in Audley Road, where I was born 2 years later. And in the front room of this house, they decided that they should go not for 240 lines, as Baird was going, and that the minimum that was asked for, but 405 lines. So that was decided in the front room of our house, I understand, one Sunday, long before Sunday Soviets were mentioned. He went on, and they did in 1936, at the end of that, they were in competition with Baird and Douglas Birkinshaw, who some of you might have heard of, who was the engineer responsible for installing both systems at Alexander Palace, said to me, it was obvious from the word go, but we had to persevere with the Baird for 3 months, but we had all these tanks of water and everything up there, and the EMI system won hands down. My father went to America to show them the system in 1937 on the Normandy. If you read American history of television, it started in 1939 when they got theirs up and running. But of course, again, we beat them. And in 1938, he read his part of the famous paper and it won the second IE premium. And this is one of the rare photographs. This is my father giving that actual paper in the IEE. And I brought along, one of the things he chose was an AC meter, and it's engraved there. He also had an AVO meter, which I've got at home, and I bought that just to show you. He was sitting a time bomb in EMI. They had all the bases of radar. They knew all about sending signals out in aerials, and theoretically, he didn't know anything about chain home. I don't believe it absolutely. Leslie Bedford at Cossels was a great friend of the family. I've met him after the war. It just is strange that here was Bedford providing these sets, receiver sets, for the chain home, and absolutely nothing was mentioned. Anyhow, my father went on to produce what Phil was referring to, is an amendment to the sound locator for trying to find aircraft. I say trying to find, you had to listen over earphones and try and locate. And as you heard, very interesting, they used blind people in the First World War because of their sensitivity. However, this came into EMI to be adapted to a system that my father had developed, whereby his binaural system with the two microphones went onto two cathode ray tubes, very much like that. You've got the two cathode ray tubes giving you elevation and bearing. As we've heard also, these were used right up to 1944. So there again, it shows that sound can be used, and it was all from his stereophonic patent. The next move, September 39, EMI go it alone again. And this time my father came up with a radar system. Here you have a diagram of it, the transmitter there, and three receiving aerials. By juggling the information round, and this again was what they were so good at in television, delays, bringing two signals together. By 1938, he had a fairy walking on somebody's hand in television. They mixed the signals. So they certainly knew how to mix signals. And if you mix the signals from the three receivers, you can get the direction, and by taking two of the receivers and using delay so that they actually come together, these, and measuring the amount of delay you've had to put in, you can get the other measurements. So it was a system that would probably work, but they didn't buy it. The ministry saw it. But then they came in and asked him to work on the AI Mark IV, and we must be very thankful because this demonstration is fantastic. Thank you very much. I've learned again some about it. This is a simplified block schematic of all the stuff in there. You can see one CRT tube there. But the most important thing was the modulator. Now, he and his team knew all about modulation of signals. They were sitting on the answer, and within 2 months they'd got it going. We've heard from Phil that they were a bit late in asking them to get it going. By that time, it was a bit late, but it went on to be used as the basis for all the other AI equipment. They improved on aerials and other features like this. And also, they had to look at where the equipment was placed. This is a block schematic of where all the equipment is in the Beaufort. You can see it's quite big equipment, and I was told by Sir Bernard Lovell last week that to demonstrate my father's sense of humour, with one bit of equipment, he was asking the RAF where he can put the equipment because it doesn't seem to be enough room. So they said, well, can't we have it sticking out of the aircraft? Says this RAF man. So my father just turned round to him and said, do you fly it with your elbows sticking out? End of story. They found space for it. But that was from Sir Bernard last week. By this time, he'd sent my mother, my brother David, and myself down to Cornwall, and he wrote to my mother every day from our house in Ealing. We had a new house in Ealing. Some days, he would write to me. I think this is rarely rather good, because if I'd been old enough to understand the significance, I would know exactly what he was doing. He was flying from Christchurch to Bournemouth. And the little boy waving there is not a little boy waving there. It's experiments to see what they can pick up from the ground. And one of the chaps would be sent out on a bicycle, and he was flying round, and there was the whole story. I might say that my mother also said that he talked an awful lot in his sleep. I believe I do, but it's nonsense. Had she been an electronic engineer, she could have been the Mata Hari of the Second World War if he wanted to. But he used to get up, jump in his car, and get back to Hayes to be there as quickly to get on with the experiment. My mother's seen him go round the corner on two wheels with the car, so he knew the mechanics of it. This is a letter sent to me. You can see the 14th of November. I was 4½ and 3 days old. I don't know whether you can read it all. I'm writing you today instead of Mummy for a change. I'm glad you are making such lovely things with your Meccano and also making things with plasticine. They had to give me the Meccano early because that was the only way I'd present flowers to Madame de Gaulle at Penzance Station. But that's another story. I'm at the office now and will stay the night there. I have a little folding bed that I put up, and quite comfortable. Your godfather, Uncle J.B. and Auntie Millicent are staying with me. Some days, a long time hence, I hope to be able to come and see you, and then we'll build a crane. So at 4½, I was meant to be an engineer. I had to know the difference between a derrick and a travelling crane. And I've got pictures of engines, but that is again another story. Anyhow, I thought that would be interesting to see because it shows how much he was really trying to bring his 4½-year son into radar. I mean, it was absolutely fatal. I was meant to go to Sitting Hills. There were places open for me. And 3 months before I did my national service, Schoenberg had me in Dr. Cutts' lab at the Research and Development. And they put me on, immediately onto microwaves, and just designed this filter. I'd come out of school, failing more exams than I'd passed, but I was meant to know how to do it. And on the second day, an engineer came out of his lab and said, "Ah, you're Blumlein. When your father died, he was helping me with this project. Perhaps you could help." And he really was being serious, because I should go back to the television days. My father was given a roving brief in EMI, and this is why he had fingers in every pie. He also smoked a pipe continuously and would make little figures out of pipe cleaners. If he'd gone into somebody's lab and seen the solution to the problem on the desk, he would write the solution and then put a pipe cleaner and say, "Sorry." Somebody told me at EMI, "I was 18 months working on a problem, and your father came into the lab, and I said, I can't get this one." And he came back with the answer fully within half an hour. It was also his belief that a circuit engineer should be able to draw a circuit and it should work. None of this try everything on the breadboard. Obviously, you've got to make certain amendments. But basically, the circuit as drawn on that piece of paper should work, and that was what he did. If he drew the circuit, he expected it to work. Now we go on to the next slide, which should say 3 centimeter klystron. This again, they were working with 10 centimeter klystrons, and they wanted to go from that bigger plane I showed you to single seater fighters. Therefore, components had to be brought down in size. Now, if you've got 3 centimetre instead of 10 centimetres, you've got better, smaller aerials and other features. And they tried to bring the 10 centimetre klystron down in size, and it just didn't work. My father came up with a solution. He put the glass copper contact exactly where there is a voltage node, and therefore you're able to then have this klystron. It became the CV87. This is an example of the... It went on to CV129, and I've got to thank Richard for putting me onto this. I've got one of these now. This diaphragm here was the tuning, and you could tune it from just below 3 centimetres to just above 3 centimetres, I believe. That was yet another solution in radar. There it is. You can inspect it. That's the original one, but there is just a flexible drive on there to tune it instead of having to stick, hand right on it. One of the things that he produced and is still being used in all sorts of forms was this doubling delay line of his. I'm very pleased to say that when I was in my 18 months of national service, I did work with it. Basically, what it is you've got 2 lines there, and you charge them up in parallel and discharge them in series. i.e., if you've got 8,000 volts coming in, the thyrotron here fires, and it gives out a pulse of 16,000 volts. Double that up on a doubling transformer and put it on a magnetron, and you got yourself a transmitter. There is a little story by and by. While I was doing my national service, I was repairing a unit, and as you did with those 19-inch racks, you stuck your soldering arm on the handle. I'm sure a lot of you have done this. And the sergeant, he was a sergeant because he signed on for life, came in and said, "Ah, Blumlein, where's the circuit diagram for the 14? "Oh, they're up there, sergeant, on the wall." So he comes in with his brand new, bought new that day, number one blue, and leans over and sees the thing. and burns down there. It seems that he took the top cap off the Thyrotron, then turned the variac up, 8,000 volts, stuck it on, and thought, oh, that top can should be on Thyrotron, and he shot out from the thing. He made us tea from that moment onwards. So, we get to this famous H2S. What it was, basically, is that Lovell was heading the team with TRE. They bought in EMI to actually manufacture the equipment, but also to engineer it so it can be manufactured. Lovell said to me that, you know, we didn't realise that there were so many circuit people in EMI who could do circuit work. They were given certain bits in TRE, so the teams went together. Now, Lindemann, who by this time was there in power, he objected to the idea of the magnetron being installed with this equipment because you couldn't blow it up in an aircraft. Well, you could. Anything can be blown up if you use enough explosion, but you couldn't get enough explosion safely into an aircraft to blow up a magnetron, which it's cut from a solid block of copper. But a Thyrotron, you can blow up. And they did. EMI were working with a Thyrotron, and Lovell's group were working with a magnetron. And the radar squadron had this plane, V9977, and you can see where underneath where the aerial was. Lovell's plane had the magnetron. EMI had the Thyrotron. It was obviously not going to be strong enough anyhow. And my father was very anxious to see the magnetron and see the kind of picture they can get. Together with C.O. Brown and Blythen, C.O. Brown's Richard's father, these three EMI engineers went up in the plane. Felix Trott, who I mentioned way back with Stereo, was meant to go, but he said, I got fed up waiting for the plane to come, so I cycled down to the officer's mess for a cup of tea, and it saved his life. But these three, together with the RAF crew, went up in this plane, and they were meant to be over the channel there, from Defford. Now, why TRE had come up to Defford was very easy. They were at Swanage, down at Worth Travers, and some brilliant, poor chap really, Air Force sergeant or flight sergeant, was parachuted in with a whole lot of commandos on a German radar station, Brunewald, that's it. And, of course, they bought out a Klaustron, useful. But then somebody had the bright idea, if we can do that to them, they can do it to us. Exit to Malvern. Anne disagrees with this one, but this is how I heard it. Anyhow, they took off from Defford. Lovell was one of the last people to see them off. And the starboard outer engine of the plane caught fire. It's been very well researched. It was researched a bit at the time, but it's been researched in the 1980s by an enthusiastic group similar to ourselves, and it was found that a fitter had not tightened one of 192 tappets on the engine, and it had dropped into the cylinder, the fire caught. If they tried to put the fire out from the cockpit, the control was on the engine side of the bulkhead, and the report finishes up, the extinguishers probably weren't full anyhow. Everything was in a rush in these days to get it through, so everybody on the plane died, including, as I said, Richard and my father. And this is what was left of the starboard engine. It was a horrendous crash. I've seen the dip, and I might be going up on June the 7th to be filmed by the BBC at the crash site. I've been there and seen the dent in the ground. Even today it's there. It was said to be a national disaster, particularly, with all due respect to Richard, the death of my father was a national disaster. In 1992, we went up to Goodwich Castle and the memorial window was unveiled by Sir Bernard Lovell. You can see the magnetron. It's a lovely window. If you're ever near Ross-on-Wye, if you're ever near there, you can see at Goodwich Castle this wonderful window. And all those killed, the RAF personnel and the civilian personnel, are named there. This is that screen with Leipzig, when they first went to Leipzig, and that is a view. It's a famous raid with H2S on Leipzig, and then there's the RAF symbols there as well. Last week I went to Jodrell Bank and had a lovely chat. I was filmed again by the BBC. We're hoping to do a film of my father's work, and he's 94, bless him. And I had a lovely private conversation, but I met him on film. But he told me that story about telling the RAF officer that you don't fly with your elbow out these days and the equipment's not going to stay outside as well. He is amazing. He's still working. And I asked him one or two questions about what do you think my father... My father's very interested in astronomy. And we'd had a bomb drop in our garden, a sentry bomb, and he left it, the hole there, so at the end of the war he could fill it with concrete and it would be the base for his homemade telescope. He was going to grind his own lenses as well. He had books on it, and he would have loved Jodrell Bank. It's a great credit, and we don't shout enough in this country about the things we do. Sir Bernard, he said to me, the thing that interests me of what your father would have done with solid state. And I always think, well, he's there anyhow. It's been said to me there isn't an active chip without one of your father's circuits in. And something I didn't mention, I can't mention, the long tail pair, is the basis, really, of input of all amplifiers as we know them in all sorts of different forms. And he did that for the coronation on May the 12th, 1937, when King George VI was coronated. And I've seen it on television. I was a year and a day. And Richard has seen it on television. He was two. But in the programme, my father's got 12 people to sign that I was in front of this television set. And there aren't many of us less, because there's only 50,000 sets by 1939. That reminds me of one thing. One of the reasons the television was turned off in 1939 was that Chain Home used similar frequencies to the television. And if they'd bought EMI and the team in 36, just think what radar we could have had. Thank you very much.
Simon Blumlein can be contacted by email at simon.blumlein, spelt Bravo Lima Uniform Mike Lima Echo India November, at btinternet.com. The speakers were asked the following four questions. Question 1. In the memorial window, the representation of the magnetron has 8 anodes, which was not the type that was normally built, which had 6 anodes. Would you like to comment?
That is artist license. Have you ever tried making stained glass? No, I can't account for that at all. Do you know any reason?
Well, I can tell you that they made two kinds of magnetron. Yes. 6 cavities and eight cavities. Mm. And the magnetron that Taffy Bowen took to the Americans when the Tizard mission was an eight-cavity magnetron. Oh. And they thought that he was pulling the wool over their eyes because it wasn't a match with the drawing that he'd handed to them. But when they turned it on and it gave 200 times the power of anything they had, they were quite happy with it.
Question 2. Would you like to comment on the misapprehension in the history books about the part the Americans played in the development of the magnetron?
Yes, we really need Peter Waddell here to be able to give you an alternative perspective. Treading carefully, what I will say is that the enormous contribution which the Americans made, and only they could have made it, was the enormous manufacturing capability. I will also say it is a relatively easier thing to be able to bring a big manufacturing capability when you have a huge home market, you are 3,000 miles away from being bombed, and you have also had a lot of your research and development in the 1939 to 40 period funded by the United Kingdom buying things from you. Now, I'm sorry if that offends people, but that is, I think, a situation that we need to understand. We had provided, through the Tizard mission, a lot of information to the United States. It was also information which had been tested in war. And the Americans, in their records of the Tizard mission, are quite clear that the things that they valued most was actually the operational experience, as well as some of the originality of the ideas, such as the developments that had been done on the magnetron. But the developments on the magnetron, as I think everyone in the room will say, came from a whole variety of different sources. It is Randall and Boot, it is Guton, it is a whole series of other people inventing and developing, strapping and manufacturing capabilities, different types of cathode for it, and so on.
Question 3. How much of the delay in getting AI into service was due to the RAF's belief, before the Second World War, that they'd rely on daylight bombing?
It was the doctrine of the Air Force. It is quite clear in all of the documentation. It was their doctrine that the way that you stopped people bombing you was going and bombing their airfields. That was their prime strategic mission. Now, increasingly, in the years after 1936, more of the resource pot that was devoted to the RAF gradually came to be devoted to defence. But when I say defence, remember that a lot of it was devoted to daytime defence, quite rightly, because the first battle that would be fought would be a daytime battle. So the amount of money that was devoted to the nighttime battle was relatively modest. But remember that point that I made about the silhouette scheme. The experimental scheme alone for silhouette cost £400,000. 40 times the amount that was given for the experimental phase of radar. So, as well as the fact that only a modest amount of money was devoted to night defence as opposed to attack, the bulk of what was actually spent was spent on a system which, as it happened in practice, did not work. Do not forget, though, that in 1943, in Germany, it did.
Question 4. The big problem with air interception was minimum range. Who set the criteria and requirement for minimum range, and for what operational reasons?
You very nicely hit upon one of the major problems in research. It is quite clear that Dowding, from at least July of 1938 and probably earlier, set the minimum range at 100 yards, and the reason was that people should get sufficiently close to identify the aircraft that they were looking at before shooting it down, remembering that this is long before effective IFF. Now, there is a contradiction in between the records and people's memories, because Bernard Lovell is very clear that the amount that they were working to in Bowen's team had for some time been 1,000 feet, and that was based on tests that had been carried out at the RAE Farnborough before the war. I can certainly trace back Dowding and his concern about the minimum being 100 yards, 300 feet, back to 1938, and I think I can push it back even earlier. I have not so far been able to trace anything from RAE Farnborough that talks about 1,000 feet. However, remember that all of the minimum ranges depend upon whether you are actually on a moonlight night or a dark night. And a lot of the interceptions that were actually achieved were achieved on moonlight nights. So the 1,200 to 1,500 feet that I showed you in the last slide as being the distance at which people picked up the aircraft they were trying to get to, you can guess that most of those, of course, would be a clear moonlight night. There is also a secondary debate, and I was asked about it during the tea break, of whether the minimum range was identified because that was the effective range of the guns. The answer to that is, before the war, yes. But after the war had started, remember that Dowding had the experience of the Battle of Barking Creek, the famous case of shoot down of our own aircraft that had been misidentified, and he was extremely concerned that there should be no repetition of that. That is quite clear through a whole series of meetings and conferences that he held. And there is one case, I have the document with me, where Rowe says, the Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command came into my office and said, if we can get a 100-yard minimum range, I will accept a quarter of a mile maximum range. Now, if you've got Dowding walking into your office and saying that as Rowe, the probability of your arguing with him is not going to be very high, I suspect.